Testing, testing. Okay, a little bit about mindfulness and a little bit about samatha, the differences. Samatha meditation, the tranquility meditation, deals with going deeper and deeper and deeper into one-pointedness, concentration, one-pointedness, which requires us to sit very still on the ground, be supported very well. And that tends to make the mind more tranquil and more focused on the object of meditation. Mindfulness, on the other hand, is really designed to simply be aware of what's going on right now. And I like the idea of, you know, you'll know you're meditating in tranquility meditation if you're using breath counting. If you remember what number you're on, you are meditating, whether you think you are or not. And with mindfulness meditation, you are mindfully meditating if you are aware of the contents of your mind. As soon as you shift from that awareness of the content to being the content of the mind, then you're no longer being mindful. You're now in the present moment experience of your life, your drama. Four kinds of mindfulness meditation: mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental objects, and mindfulness of the body. So we're able to sort of pick and choose which one. Mindfulness of the body, you might be simply aware of the posture you're in. Are you sitting? Are you kneeling? Are you lying? Are you standing? And it's that simple awareness that could be your practice. So one day you will say, I'm going to keep track of all my postures today. And when I change my posture, I'm going to be aware of that change. So we're sitting and we stand up and we are aware of the standing and the process of standing. And then when we sit again, we are aware of going back into sitting. And it's simply noting. It's not defining it as being a good transition or not a very good transition. It's simply being aware of where your body is. In the 12-link chain of causation, it's called Paticca-samuppada. The 12 links have been used as a model of why we suffer. And if we can break one of the links, we can end our suffering. And oftentimes, the link that's broken is the link on sensation. And I don't remember on the top of my head what all the links are. One is birth, one is death. One of the aggregates, but one of the links is sensation. So as a mindfulness meditator, we might simply be aware of the sensations of our body and our mind. The sensations of our body are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The sensations of our mind are pleasant and unpleasant, and generally speaking, not neutral. So we could simply be aware of sensations. And as you're going through your day, you say you're stiff. And rather than cursing the stiffness, now you simply are aware of the stiffness. By becoming aware of these different sensations, what we are eventually trying to do is see in each one of them the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom. So mindfulness meditation requires a lot of mindful activity, whereas concentration exercises are designed to bring to a halt, if possible, all conscious activity. So what are the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom that the mindfulness meditator would be going for? The first one would be impermanence, that they would look in all those sensations and all those different forms of the body, for instance, and see impermanence, that no position stayed the same very long. We stood for a while, we sat for a while, we lied down for a while, we sat for a while, we stood for a while. But we didn't do one for a really long time, except maybe lying as we sleep. But even then, there's tossing and turning. And why? Why can't the body stay in one position very long? Because it's inherently painful to stay in one position too long. And for me, it wasn't obvious until I started to sit in meditation and not move. And then I'm going, this is really excruciating. You know, and apparently that had always been there. It wasn't something that happened because I was meditating. It was something I became aware of because I was meditating, that it's difficult to have a body. Now, I sleep on a futon. And does anybody else here sleep on a futon? Everybody has a bed? Okay. Well, I like a futon. And the reason I like a futon is because it's a bit ascetic. You know, after sleeping on it for 10 years, it becomes like a rock. And it doesn't give. And what I realized is I got a better night's sleep on this really difficult to sleep on futon than I did in a very comfortable giving bed. So I'm thinking, why do I get a more restful sleep on this ungiving bed? And then I figured it out, because when I had a really comfortable soft bed, I could go to bed really tense and uptight, and the bed would take my shape. And I could hold my tension all night long and not relax at all. The bed took my form. But now when I slept on this really stiff futon, I had to relax because the bed wasn't going to give. And once I was able to relax into the stiff bed, I slept like a baby. Now, who would have thought? Okay, so I'm looking with these sensations of the body, and I'm saying, yeah, you know, sometimes with these sensations of the body, I try to repress them, I try to ignore them, you know, and that's when the trouble starts. So by becoming aware of pleasant and unpleasant, I am acknowledging the perfection and imperfection of this human form. And that allows me to come to a place of acceptance with both pleasure and displeasure, pleasure and discomfort. Okay. If everything's impermanent, I can't get too attached to the pleasurable because it'll soon change. If it's really unpleasant, I'm thankful impermanence exists because I know it's only a matter of time until something else will happen. It'll either get worse or it'll get better, but it won't stay the same. Okay. This leads us into this sort of unsatisfactoriness now. The mindful meditator applying his mind now to the philosophy of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self, sees that in fact all the sensations, for instance, ultimately led to suffering. In the same way, all the positions, standing, lying, sitting, always led to suffering. So we had to change them. The good stuff was suffering because it changed, and the bad stuff was suffering just because it was bad. So if you put impermanence and suffering together, you could look at your life and say, you know, most of my life is uncomfortable because it's always in a constant state of flux, and I keep attaching to the good and pushing away the bad. And that's the wrong technique. I need to have acceptance with both, and then I won't suffer. Then I can still experience the good. I will now be able to experience the bad, but neither of them will be a problem, theoretically. And you know, it's so easy to say this, and it's so hard to go on the 405 freeway. Now, the third one is the most difficult one of all, because what the mindful meditator now is going to say to themselves is the fact that nothing has an essence, nothing has an original independent characteristic that we can point at and say that's the true nature of that thing. For instance, you could look at a chair and you say to yourself, well, what's the true nature of the chair? And the meditator would say, well, there isn't one. It's in a constant state of flux. Nothing is independent from that. Everything is conditional. One thing happens because of several other things, but nothing can exist independently. So now the process starts to work, this philosophy, this wisdom, this understanding, this seeing through. Vipassana is often translated as seeing through. So you're seeing through the true nature of what it means to be you. And you start to see that you, in fact, do not have a soul in the way you thought you did. You do not have an original essence that's independent and unconditional the way you thought you did. And when this deep insight becomes real to you, you start to let go of the world around you in a very positive way, not a negative way. You don't commit suicide. But what you start to see is that you're only suffering because you want it to be a certain way, and it's not. You're only suffering because you think there's something in you that can hold on or push away something in it, and in fact there's nothing in you or it that exists independently, that you are connected, you are codependent, you are interdependent with everything and all things, all the time, every time. And this sort of like profound non-attachment occurs in the meditator's life. That nothing ever becomes a big deal and nothing ever becomes a small deal. Nothing has inherent value. Nothing is ultimately beautiful or ugly, ultimately perfect or imperfect, ultimately good or bad. It doesn't exist inside the thing. It exists because of the value we've given it, because we have a deluded perspective on how it exists. We see it as being independent. So the mindfulness meditator approaches it with a whole lot of thinking. And that's the part that did me in. Because I thought a lot anyway. And it made me so agitated that I would keep, you know, mindfully reflecting on all the stuff I was thinking about. Oh, God. So I was thinking twice as much. And my opinions didn't go away. I would look at my opinions and I'd see I had many more opinions than I was ever aware of. Oh, man. And how was I going to find peace? You mean the world is screwed up? Everybody in the whole world is messed up? I can't do this. I don't want to see it this clearly. And that's when I took refuge in tranquility meditation. That I could say, okay, I'm just going to go into this one point. I'm going to meditate on the sensation of breath. I'm going to be in that sensation. I'm going to get rid of my past and future. I'm going to get rid of my discursive thought. I'm going to get rid of all my opinions for just a few minutes and just sit there in blissful ignorance and let the world crumble around me. May Rome burn while I sit. And I realized that what I was doing is I was creating a cocoon of samadhi. I was encapsulating myself in this sort of bliss of concentration. It was being my prophylactic. And I'd scrunch into it and I'd go out into the world and all the same information was just charging at me. And it would hit this cocoon and it would sort of slow down and then it would just sort of like softly, gently fall all over my body. And I'm thinking, I can deal with the world in this way because now I don't have to just have it come at me as like a bullet. Now it's coming at me and it's just sort of like giving me a chance to get ready for it, to either accept it or reject it, to give it meaning or not. And I had a choice then, you know, and I was more able to see clearly the problems, the insights that I was having, and I was able to integrate those insights into my everyday life and my worldview because of my samadhi practice. And it didn't work with straight mindfulness for me. Mindfulness was just too much information, too fast, and I couldn't integrate it. And that's one of the reasons I see there's a big problem with drugs, is because drugs will oftentimes let you have this sort of 12-hour experience, perhaps psychedelics, of ultimate reality. Well, you know, 12 hours of ultimate reality, how many years will that take to integrate? That's a lot of stuff. And those are life-changing insights. I mean, that's stuff that you have to just sort of ease into your worldview so you don't go bananas. And now and then, just having these little insights, these little, you know, this partial break in this mundane relative reality, and it just one veil might lift just for a moment, and you see something, and you go, whoa, cool. But now you got days and months to integrate. It's not all at once, and it's not chemically derived. And so, you know, I must say that I was never much of a drug person. I was more beer and cigarettes, you know. And that seemed to satisfy all my needs. And when I found meditation, what I started to see was the parallel approach to maybe psychedelic drugs and meditation. That chemically, we could all be yogis. But the problem was, is you were dependent on the chemical for your enlightenment. And Ram Dass talks about this a lot. He said that's the issue with taking LSD, Ram Dass says, is that you don't have the insights unless you take it. And so you're stuck. And we don't want to be stuck, even with a candle. We want to be self-sufficient. And I see that as where we have the opportunity of growing as human beings, gaining these insights, integrating them, allowing people to be who they need to be without proselytizing what's wrong with them because you've had the insight and they haven't and you can see it and they can't and that's what's wrong with them and that's what's right with me and da-da-da-da. We never want to go there. Sometimes we need to let people be asleep. We can't wake them up. We're working on waking ourselves up. And I find the more we wake up in this spiritual practice, the more we look at our reality, cultural or otherwise, and see it as being very transparent and having little or no value at all, other than the fact we can all somehow make a living together, you know, and pay the rent and have a place to live. And, you know, for 8 million people, that's a big deal. So it doesn't surprise me when meditators, you know, end up living in a small shack in the woods, you know, or they join an ashram in India for the rest of their life, or they go on a pilgrimage and just wear a loincloth and want to get, you know, burned on the funeral pyre and thrown in the Ganges, you know. And you go, wow, is that what life's all about? Well, maybe so. Maybe it is. Maybe everything else we just make up. So for me, my meditation practice became a way of growing in a very personal way, expanding my awareness and then integrating that expansion in a way that allows me to live in a fairly normal, practical way and doesn't make too many people suspicious, you know, about me, you know? Because, and again, we don't want to be mystical. We don't want to be like those yogis who talk softly. We just want to be sort of like normal and fit in with everybody. And then we're just sort of normal and so normal that nobody ever sees us. You know, we're in line, they don't even see us. Wow. There's nobody there to see. You know, and old people have that happen all the time and they're not even practicing. Nobody sees old people anymore. You know, have you ever seen the some old guy in a restaurant? He's always the last one to get waited on. At least it seems that way to me, maybe because I'm getting old. But there was a guy in a restaurant just last night who nobody ever said anything to him. He's an old guy who sat down looking at the menu, and nobody said anything to him, and he just left. And there were young couples coming in with kids, and they were always got all the attention because there was the chaos of children. So it's interesting. So we can become invisible either through age or we can become invisible through our practice, but that invisibility allows us to be very special in a way. You know, I hope that wasn't too weird. Did that help when it comes to mindfulness? Yeah.
I liked everything you said.
Okay. It does make sense then. Okay. Good. Yeah.
I have a question about mindfulness. The way you describe it, it almost sounds like when you practice yoga, you're mindful of the poses that you're doing, so it's like a physical thing, and then you're also mindful of your breath, so you're, you know, you're thinking of your sensation. So would you consider yoga as a form of meditation?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a movement form of meditation, but also it fits into mindfulness of the body because you're very much aware of your posture and your breathing. So, sure, yeah, I would definitely consider it to be part of it. And what does mindful mean? It means your mind is filled with the stuff you're doing right now. That's all. You're not thinking about tomorrow or yesterday. You just, whatever you're doing right now, that's what your mind is full of. And the Zen folks are fond of saying, when you chop wood, you chop wood. When you carry water, you carry water. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why anybody would say that in the first place. And then it just sort of made sense that, yeah, when you're chopping wood, you're just chopping wood. You're not doing anything else. You're not thinking about anything else. And we're so used to multitasking in our everyday life that we're expected to think about two or three things, you know? And then we're sort of, you know, we don't do very well. So now I have a luxury of being able to do some stuff and not be interrupted and not be distracted, you know? And I never really appreciated it before, but when I was in the workaday world, there's so many things that distract you, and everybody wants your attention and your time, and you can't finish this project because you're getting another project to do, and you just go, if only. And to have the joy of having like 6 hours during the day, you probably will never have this again, of just being able to do something, you know, and just to test it out. Like today I was working on this video concept I have of Dharma Talks video instead of podcasts. You know, and so it required me to, you know, shoot some video and then process it through my 1995 video processor I got off of eBay. And then I was testing different size files to see, you know, which would be better to upload and what's the quality different in the different files and so 5 hours later, you know, I'm still working on this. But I had a chance to really learn a lot and get some on-hands experience of what I want to do and what I need to avoid to have it turn out pretty good.
Wouldn't put this exactly the right way, because the easy way to say this, sort of the goal in life or everything else, but is to be able to do just what you're saying in everything that you do.
Yes. That is exactly right. Whether they want you to multitask or not, yeah, that's to be mindful and to be in the moment and in the process, you know, yeah, not to be apart from it, and say, oh, I wish it was going faster because then I could do this as well, and I tell you what, the computer works just as fast, and the downloading works just as fast, and the uploading works just as fast, and there you sit, you know, doing mindfulness meditation as it uploads to your server. You know, and it's fine. You know, that's exactly the point. Exactly, this we want to get to a place where we are mindful of everything we do, but it really starts with the practice of sitting down and getting your mind ready for mindfulness. And getting your mind ready for mindfulness is being one-pointed, because in a way you're mindful of one thing. That's your life, and those other components are happening right now, but you're not. You're not separating them into their own compartments anymore. That's just, you're carrying water. And how do you carry water? Well, first you have to get the water, and then you have to carry it. And then are you carrying it any place, or are you just carrying it? Well, you're carrying it until carrying is done. You go, okay, I guess carrying is done. And sometimes when I'm waiting for something, I'll say to myself, when waiting is filled, then there'll be something else to do. But waiting isn't filled yet. So I wait. And one of my favorite books from the 70s was Stranger in a Strange Land, Robert Heinlein. Michael J. Smith was the guy. And it was wonderful. It's about this alien that comes down. I think David Bowie played it in the movie. It wasn't very popular. And this guy was in the present moment all the time. This guy was like, you know, doing mindfulness. I didn't know it at the time I was reading it that that's what he was talking about. But he was being very mindful all the time. When waiting is filled, he would say. You know, in the last paragraph, if I'm not mistaken, it said something very profound. It said that he was even able to see God in a blade of grass. So he's lying on the ground dying because I think somebody shot him or something, those earthlings. and he looked at the blade of grass and said, "Thou art God." You know, and I'm going, "Wow, he's right there." You know, right there. So, yeah, that's the goal. And our mind is not designed initially to meet that goal. So we have to transform it. And that's what this is, the practice of transformation. Yeah. Cold, isn't it? I tell you, you really couldn't have a better room. This is like a Korean zendo, you know. It's always cold in Korea. And yet they sit anyway, you know. So speaking of sitting, shall we sit a little bit before the class is over? We've got a few minutes, you know? It'd be a nice way to end the class.